I'm very nervous. My name is Scotty Martin. I'm an alcoholic. Grace of a higher power, I'm sober in this fellowship tonight. And I've never been in Cartersville, Georgia. I'm a long way from home, but home is where the heart is, and I believe I should be here this Saturday night. I also know my script, but there's a couple of things I want to say, and that I can't remember. I want to thank the committee for the hospitality shown to me. You know, when I came in here, in my room there was a gift, which was nice, and I'm delighted, and the friendliness shown by you Georgians is wonderful, and that I appreciate. I really do. Alcoholics Anonymous is a miracle factory, and I'm glad to be part of it. Before I go any further, when our co-founder died, Bill W. died in January of 1971, when he passed on, in that Heart Institute in Miami, Florida, on his bedside table there was a plant amongst many, one called Swedish Ivy. And Lowe's took it back up to Bedford Hills, up to Stepping Stones. And myself and other people were privileged to get a cutting from that plant. And we kind of took it all over Westchester and Connecticut, where I was at that time. And I brought it down south a couple of years ago and gave it to people. So this is a 26-year plant that is spread all over. What I'd like to do tonight, I did bring a gift, I did bring the plant, and I would like, if I may, to give it to Gladys in memory of Groves, if she's here. Is she here? This is a... She can pick it up after the meeting. I heard you're a green thumb. And you'll take care of it, right? And listen, I'm awfully nervous. I'm awfully nervous, and all the previous speakers wore jackets, and you know, I'm a copycat. Jacket. So can I tell you a wee joke to get me off this nervous thing, okay? As you can guess, I'm not from Cartersville, Georgia. I'm from across the pond. And they drink over there too. They have been known to drink, and there was a wifey there who thought her husband, Angus, drank too much. And like any good American wife, she nagged at him on occasion, and he said, "You drink too much, Angus." And he said, "I don't. And if you had my problems, I would drink, you would drink too," and so on and so on. So she went to the doctor finally and described what was going on with Angus. And she said, "You know, this fellow was, he's really killing himself." And the doctor says, "Well, I'll get him in on a pretense." So a couple of weeks later, he sees him on the street there in the village, and he says, "Come on into my surgery and we'll talk about things." And Angus went to the surgery and he sat him down and he talked about golf, which we do over there. And small stuff, and he's watching Angus, and Angus has a wonderful flush that you get in a country where they have no sunshine. You get it in Georgia here because of the sun, but you know, over there it's flush because of good old 12-year-old scotch. And he notices a little tremor in his face, and he notices the veins breaking down and a little puffiness in the ankles, and he says to him, "Angus, put your hands up." And he puts his hands out and it's like that. And he said, "Relax, Angus, you'll be all right, be all right." We talked a little further. He said, "Angus, do that again, would you?" And Angus puts his hands out, and they're like that. And he said, "Angus, I'm afraid you drink a bit too much." "Oh, I don't, doctor," he said. "I spill most of it." I feel a little better. I tell you something, what I'm here to do actually is to share my experience, strength and hope with what I have seen, what I have heard and what I have felt. I cannot go outside of that experience. I cannot tell you how you ought to stay sober. I can tell you how I got sober and how this program works for me in keeping me sober. But I have a suspicion that wherever we go in this world, that whoever does these things that are suggested probably stays sober. And anything I say is my own opinion and not the opinion of this group or this convention or Roundup or the opinion of Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. It is my opinion, and I know what a contrary bunch we are out there. And so someone said, how did he say that? I don't believe that. Don't believe it. It's okay. When I come through these doors, you know, it's they talk about a well-balanced Scotsman has a chip on both shoulders, so I know all about that, you know what I mean? And so I was feisty and I looked around and I saw differences and stuff like that, so I know what goes on in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hear people giving a sobriety date. I ought to give it. I'm sober by the grace of a higher power, the 29th of September 1963. And I was very, very young. I was about 6.5 years old. But I do know that I was 6 weeks sober when that young president was shot, and I thought I should go out and drink, but I didn't. A lot of things happen. But and I've just lost it, but it's going to come back. You know, there is brain damage. I know what I was going to say, and that's the brain damage. I was born in Camlachie, Scotland, in 1934. The only reason I give you that date is because there was another man being reborn about 3,500 miles away in Central Park West in a little brownstone building called Giles B. Towns, and his name was Bill W., and he was getting this program ready for me, because 29 years later I was in that town's hospital with my exposure to this fellowship. So they all laid the groundwork. Now I know there's a lot of whiskey being drank out there, and I know you're all figuring out how old is he. I will save you the trouble. There's a lot of brain damage. I'm 42. Or free. I don't know. Alright, so don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. I hear people saying, and we can agreeably disagree sometimes, because we're all humans, that, you know, I always felt different. I'm not sure if I felt different prior to picking up a drink. I was brought up in a kind of wholesome attitude over there in those years, and I had brothers and sisters, and I was average academically and I was average athletically, and I fitted in okay. I didn't feel left out. I didn't feel as if I had a poor father image or whatever this 20th century psychobabble that goes on. I just felt I was a young kid. I didn't realize I was poor, by the way, until I came here and see how you fellows live. But we was never poor in spirit. It was okay. I climbed trees and I played football, soccer as you call it, and I felt all right. And I say that respectfully because I did not feel out of it. I'll tell you when I did feel out of it, and this is where the magic of this stuff comes in. 15, 16, when chemically I'm probably changing and my eyes going away from the soccer ball to those girls. And it is at that time that I discover that I'm tremendously shy. But I think that that is probably a teenage thing rather than an alcoholic thing. It was not helped by the fact that I had what the medics call acne vulgaris. And you people know what that is, but in layman's language it was pimples. At that age one gets pimples. And I thought the whole world was looking at me with these things, which shows you how involved I was with self. And so therefore I did not have what the French call savoir-faire with the girls, or what we call out here cool. And so therefore I'm back to the soccer ball for a couple of years. I had a happy childhood. It was a rather long one, I may tell you, but it was kind of happy. Not only in here do we not grow up, we know we grow old, but we have a chance to grow up too. But you know, I had a happy, long childhood. But I tell you, at age 18, you know, I was in Britain, British Isles, and we were subject to the military service. And I went in, And I went down to England to do training, and in recreation time, another thing along with that stuff about feeling different, I think I feel very close to you when I'm in this room tonight as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can sit with you. But my ideas of recreation might be different. My sense of humor might be different. I may come from a different culture. But I tell you, and I feel like you, when I'm in this room and we're discussing recovery, I belong. I also could walk down into Cartersville tonight and go into, if you have a pub down there, a bar down there, I could go in and look around very quickly after all these years if I wanted to drink, and I could slip into a stool, if they still have stools, and I'd put my money, and I'd buy cigarettes immediately, and I'd put my lighter on top of it like I used to do, and I'd look around, I'd get a couple of drinks, and I'd talk to the fellow next to me and buy him a drink probably, and I would be home. And that's when I feel like you, and that's when I feel part of you, and I'd find out what the local gossip is, or the local jokes are, and I could fit right in. And I'd find out who won the baseball last year, because you have to know those things when you're a bar drinker, and within a couple of weeks, I would be home. But when I leave here, my ideas of, this fellow Walter, whom I insult all the time, he drove me here, because when he drives me here, he gives me what they call sensitivity training. He confronts me all the time, confrontation therapy, tells me this, tells me that. I don't know where he is, but his ideas of recreation are nothing like mine. But when we're in that car coming here, when we talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, we are home. Anywho, I went south to do basic training, got some leave. Still was tremendously shy, was 18 years old, say 17 and change, had probably had a bottle of beer, was not important, wasn't looking forward to it, but went to a dance hall, which was the style then, in my uniform, because you could not wear civilian clothes, had the same old feelings, and some fellow said to me, probably a fellow Scotsman, have a couple of bottles of that English beer. And I had two bottles of that English beer, and I got to tell you something, those pimples disappeared, and I danced like a stare. And I was the British equivalent of, who was the movie star then, Robert Taylor, Clark Gable. I was very, very comfortable. That's about, I will admit to that. I did not need it. I did not need the stuff when I was mixing with the fellows. I did not need it when I played soccer, when I discussed with the men what was going on. But vis-a-vis the dance hall situation, my brain said, comfort. As I go across that dance hall, of those little English girls said, oh, get away from me, you terrible Scotsman. It did not hurt. It very rarely happened. Or if they said, oh, you're terrific, I say, of course. Good taste. So at that moment, alcohol did for me. But why I'm here is because what it did to me. That's why I'm here. And I ought to disclose in a general way, as it's suggested in the fifth chapter, what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And so therefore, I'm on my weary way. I place great importance on the stuff from that moment. Anytime I was on leave or off-duty time, I would go down to those villages, get a couple of drinks, feel different and better probably. Went through my stage of throwing up, I served my apprenticeship well. I would go to this dance hall scene, and that was it. So therefore, whether one is born an alcoholic, whether one gets it by ingestion, I don't know. I suspect maybe that the alcoholism was within me prior to picking up the booze, because I'm of the belief that alcoholism doesn't come in bottles, it comes in people. And you have to open up the bottle, of course, to drink it, to fire up the furnace. But it was probably within me. But that's the way it was. And it was good fun with it. In case some of you are fairly new, I had good fun with alcohol in the beginning, you know. I danced and I rolled in the mud and I sang those Irish songs and I did silly little things that young men do. And I had good fun, I think. The longer if good fun means you're locked up and you get into fights in bars, I had good fun. You know, hey, how about that? And I had a habit of exaggerating how much I drank in those early days. you know, those Englishmen can't drink like us Scots, you know what I mean? So you would go back to the barracks and you would tell them, hey, I drank 6 of your big bottles of beer, I probably drank 4. Later in my alcoholism, when I could drink 24 and the cop would stop me, I'd say, I just had a couple, officer. We always have a couple. A couple of what, you know? A couple of these, a couple of those, a couple of this. But alcoholism was being, I went overseas, let's rush through this, because I went overseas, Britain had the kind of military responsibility that we now have, and we met with as much criticism as we now do. And I was in the RAF, the Royal Air Force, used to call us the glamour boys. I don't know why I was in there. I think they gave us tests and they determined that I should be in there rather than in the army. And that was okay. I got away from home. Overseas I went to places, the end of Korea was there, went to East Africa when the Mau Mau trouble started, and all I did, and the Middle East generally, and all I did was now associate with people who had the same attitude about alcohol that I did. And that was, you get paid, you get drunk. You have a good time. You fall down. You're a hard man. Okay? There was probably people in there who wrote home to their girlfriends, who had plans. I would hear these terrible square people who lived in the future, and of course I wasn't even in AA, and I lived one day at a time even then in the most negative fashion. Today you get drunk and we'll see what happens tomorrow, and I was not drunk all the time, believe me. But it was creeping into my system. Great importance was placed on this stuff, what it could do for me. Now there was no girls to be shy from. Now I was in a part of the world where there was strong sunshine and those pimples disappeared. Now I was older, they would have disappeared anyway. But if you'd have said to me, why are you drinking in this tent in Egypt? I would say, what else is there to do? There was a lot to do. They played soccer at 6 in the morning before it got too hot. They wrote to those girlfriends. They took university courses. They had plans. I never mixed with those. I had a great ability to find the people who felt and acted the way I did. I believe they call it birds of a feather, and that's why I love all of you, because you are all birds of a feather. I try to tell some new people today, I say, you know, when you come through these doors and you do, and these are the people you'd be drinking with 10, 5, 8, in my case maybe a little longer, years ago. These are the same people. So I found you. They tell us that alcoholism is a disease. I believe it's an equal opportunity to disease too. You don't have to be Irish to have this disease. It helps a little bit. And I know that, and I say that with jest. I got sober in New York City and with a big Irish Catholic population up there. And maybe that line doesn't, but you know, we laugh about that. A little black girl got up one day with a Kelly green dress on. She says, I heard you don't have to be Irish to be alcoholic. And I said, that's right. But it helps. It helps. It gets us there quicker. And anyhow, I was getting into the use and obviously the abuse of the stuff. Now I'm drinking a little too much. Now I'm suffering hangovers. Now they tell me as I come into Alcoholics Anonymous years later that I have a disease, that I am without ease, that I have no ease. That is a breakdown of the word, apparently. I'm without ease. I have a disease. I don't know that. I just know I'm having hangovers and I'm making excuses and I'm blaming Egypt or anywhere. Later on it was Illinois. I have the great ability to blame and indict people, places and things for my situation. That seems to be the nature. I have a disease that shows symptoms. There are other illnesses out there that show symptoms, and I suspect that because I'm thick and male, I will not go to the doctor and try to take care of it myself. But let me tell you folks, if those symptoms persisted, I suspect I would go to a physician. But with this illness, because it's threefold in nature, it tells me there's nothing wrong with me. I have a disease that tells me I don't have a disease. presents amazing symptoms. I mean, it is not normal for a 19 or a 20-year-old to be kneeling on the toilet floor doing what you all described. Doing that and looking in and seeing your face all quivering as the stuff hits the commode, that is not the way to start a morning off. There's something wrong with that. And yet my brain says, I won't always do this. When I get out of this hellhole, you know I won't do this. So there was this journey starting of the progression of my disease, and they tell me it's progressive. I think Jack today says, or it was some of them, or maybe it was Jay yesterday, someone said, you know, like, this disease does get worse. He doesn't know anyone who goes out and comes back in. I often say that once a cucumber becomes a pickle, it can never be a cucumber again, and I'm a pickle. I cross over a line somewhere where that happens. It's an X factor, or call it what you want, but all I know is my journey, but I have a denial within me, and like any good alcoholic, they say that we have no willpower. You know we have willpower. You know I climbed over fences to get into towns in Egypt and somewhere when I should be back at base because there was a red alert on. I would be in town drinking with Arabs and laughing about it. I'd be in jail and be bailed out and feel quite proud that I'd spent time in an Egyptian jail. Rubbish. Absolute rubbish. Having a good time. Okay? Never quite saw that other people didn't do that, because again, always mixing with that 2 or 3. 10% of people who drink apparently in time will show the symptoms of this disease called alcoholism. And like most people, I had an idea of who an alcoholic was. And you know who an alcoholic was. It wasn't me. I mean, I'm a young man. When I'm not drunk, I can run a mile, I can walk, I can talk, I have some skills. Those alkies are the people I saw in my hometown, and certainly saw them when I came to the States in the long parts of the city, under the bridges. And those are the alkies, and they're old. They're as old as my friend Walter, wherever he is here. I insulted him again, you know. And they look like him. If you don't know Walter, take a look at him. I love the guy. I'm just joking. I don't know where he is. He probably won't drive me home. So it was not me. Alright, that denial was in there from the beginning. It doesn't matter what my head says, the progression will determine where I go. I come back from overseas, back to the United Kingdom. I'm restless. I now know why. I have that runaway theme, you know, fight and flight. And I'm moving. United States beckons. My image of the United States is those wonderful films of the 50s where it seemed to me that no one worked. They were all musicals, you know, Donald O'Connor. I mean, a sophisticated man like me should have known. But, you know how smart we are. But I did not know. And I have compounded ignorance, you know. I didn't know I didn't know. And that's dangerous. That is really dangerous. And I thought that was America. Donald O'Connor dancing down Broadway, and everything was parties, and they wore those wonderful tuxedos, and they fell out with their girlfriends, and they got together again. There was limousines. I'm going. I am going there. Came here in the late 50s. Was subject to the, I was 24 years old, subject to the military draft before I was 26. It was a good melting pot for me. Within 3 or 4 weeks I was in Texas, I was in the United States Air Force. My skills from the RAF took me to the USAF. That was just fine. What did I do? I brought this disease of alcoholism into this fine country, and found and sought and did find people who felt the way I did. And whether your accent was from Georgia or Wisconsin or New York City, I don't care, you feel the same way I do. And I found the 10%, and we just drank. Went up to Illinois, was to be stationed there for a couple of years, and it was here that my disease, the progression of this illness, reared its ugly head. Here not only was the physical parts of this illness now showing, and the physical part always was there. My philosophy was, you play, you pay. I could take that. You know, we're tough guys. You know, we can chew Rolaids. We can go 4 days without food. You know, we can throw up the alley and go back in the bar. Do you think civilians would do that? Do you think civilians would throw up and go back into a bar and drink again? Only we do it. And they accuse us of having no willpower? How dare they? Progression. progression came on, I was now being held up, being stood up in front of commanders, asking, why are you doing this? You know how civilians ask us people, why are you doing this? You, I mean, why did they say that? Us alkies don't say that to each other. Why do you drink like that, Scotty? And I remember one time in Chinook Field, they used to call it, I don't know what the age group is here, there's a whole generation never done military service, but I'm 41 or 2, so you know that I've done my military service. But there's a whole gang won't know, but some of you are old enough to remember, there's a field up there called Chinook Field in Illinois. They used to say, don't shoot them, Chinook them. And it was all right. But in front of that commander with a straight face, I said, sir, I come from a very hilly country, and it's so flat here that I find I have to drink. I'm embarrassed 38 years later. And he looked at me and he let me off or something, okay? But I did my time. What was happening to me, I was being held back from promotions, and the mental aspect of this illness began to come into my life. Spiritually, I was off always. Physically, I was suffering. Mentally, that insidious part of this illness now began to say to me, Scotty, you should never have come out to this country. Scotty, how come he's promoted and you're not? It's because he does this and you don't. Lying in bed and sleepless nights, thinking of this kind of thing, the rationalization. Like a lot of alcoholics, and I've heard that in these rooms, opportunities come up and I jumped at it. There was a young president came into power and he said, I want a man on the moon in 10 years, in a decade, because the Russians were sending those things up. They had that little ball running around going beep, beep, beep. If you read look at your history channel, you'll know all about it. And we were embarrassed. Those vanguards were going up 10 feet and falling down and exploding. And they wanted us to be there. Now, where do I fit in? A Scotsman drunk? I'll tell you where I fitted in. I had what they call a medical AFSC, Air Force, I don't know what it is, I think Air Force Specialty Code. Someone after me will tell me the exact meaning, but my AFSC qualified me to go into a very elite team to cover these upcoming space shots and to pick up space hardware. And the reason I volunteered was to get the hell out of Illinois, because I was unhappy. And you know why I was unhappy? Because if you were in Illinois, you would drink too. And if some of you are from Illinois, you know I'm joking. And I volunteered, and they laughed at me. They said, Scotty, for God's sake, you know what that requires? And I said, yes, I know. And they didn't quite say you were drunk, but they said, you know. And that determination, that arrogance that existed, this alcoholic, I said, I'll show them. And at night time when it was all dark, no one jogged in those days, but night time when it was dark, I would go along those roads in that airbase, and I would walk rapidly and run a little bit and walk and run. And within a few months, I presented this body to the orderly room again, and they looked at me and thought, I'm serious. They sent me off, and lo and behold, there was many courses, and I don't want to really talk about it, but it's so long ago, but where there was washouts in many of those courses, I got through. Because I wasn't drinking. And with each graduation, I thought, hey, look at that, there's nothing wrong with me, I'm okay. Now I was on flying status where I should have been from the very beginning. Now this was exciting. Now I was in a prestigious, glamorous outfit which served this ego, the sick ego. You see, if you looked at my uniform then, you would see who I was. Because any military man can look and see what you're wearing. He knows where you've been from Korea on down. But you'd never know what I was. And in this room tonight, I'm telling you what I was. I was a little boy in that uniform who really nice wanted to go back to his mummy. Because I was full of self-pity. But I went through those things. Now I'm on flying status. Now I'm doing the things I think are fine. I'm a ticking time bomb. I do some good things that I've been trained to do. The highlight of my career was in 62, in April of that year, when one of the astronauts, Scott Carpenter, went off course. His retrofire was about 2 seconds longer than it should have been. We were sitting down off our naval station called Roosevelt Roads, Puerto Rico, Rosie Roads, the old salts would call it. And they should have landed up Bermuda. The United States Navy, we were responsible for the pickup of this astronaut. We were there as Air Force for contingency reasons, emergency reasons. And I had been in a jail in Old San Juan the night before, not because I was in choir practice in that old cathedral, but because you know what I was doing. I was in jail with the flight engineer, and he was terrified that we were on duty the next day to cover the space shot, thinking, well, she's never going to come near us anyway. It's supposed to land up beside USS Kearney. We're 200 miles downrange. At 17,500 miles an hour, when that retro burn is two seconds long, you land in my lap in Puerto Rico. I got out of jail because I said with my most arrogant and authoritative manner, I was in civilian clothes, call the British ambassador. You know, call the British ambassador and get me out of here. I didn't tell him I was military. Long story short, he made us sweep the cell and we got out, got back to base. Next day, a massive hangover, scrambled for that thing, secured that capsule for this astronaut when the Navy was uprange. And that was it, kids. That was Mike. Brought up to New York to be shown off, because there was inter-rivalry between the military services, and then there may still be, I'm out of touch. And the Air Force wanted to show their capabilities and their versatility of these people. What we were called pararescue. I think probably now they're SEALs. I don't know. We're called pararescue. Doesn't matter. Nothing matters except sobriety. But anyway, brought up to New York, and I say this with amusement. There was a couple of shows back then. Some of you remember them if you're old enough. One was called I've Got a Secret. And I smile at that because you know I had a secret. And the other one was To Tell the Truth. I mean, and I think it was Bud Collier. And the deal was that we would go on those shows, and they would have two of those Californian muscle men and this little wet Scotsman who was hung over sitting there, and we all had crew cuts in, and they would say, this so-and-so picked up the astronaut. Of course, they would pick Mr. Muscles, and the idea was you'd win more. Long story short, I picked up a drink, and in those days, now my progression is such that when I pick up a drink, the drink picks up a drink. I cannot predict my behavior. There are times when I will pick up several drinks, I'll get home safely to my room on the base, and I'll get to bed. I will drink the same amount the next day or the day after it, and I'll be in jail. And always alcohol associated. There's Walter. I didn't get in trouble every time I drank, but any time I was in trouble, it was because of drink. See, so I did have good fun, I did have those songs. But when I was in trouble, in jail, being held back, booze, booze, booze. It was never for looking through a lady's window. It was never for starting a car and running off with it, which doesn't make me good. But I'm trying to tell that it was always booze associated. Now I picked up a drink, didn't make those commitments, was brought back to base, asked that silly question that civilians ask us, why did you do that? There was a mixture of emotions in them, because I had done the work that I had been trained to do, had given the Air Force some good publicity, but I had fouled some of it up. And I just looked at them with that stare that Alkies can manage, and just stared them down, feeling ashamed, feeling angry, feeling confused. Now you understand that I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I probably did. I was average well-read. I probably read an article, but I had the image it was those guys who were as old as Walter, you know, and needed this program, and it certainly wasn't me who was an Air Force Blue who had all those esoteric skills. In that room one day, I realized now as I'm speaking, someone slipped a pamphlet under my door, and I suspect back then, we're dealing with 1961 or 2, that it was probably the old Johns Hopkins test, where they asked you 12 questions, you know, like, have you ever lost work? Have you? And I remember ticking them off, but there was one there that said, do you ever drink alone? And I very smugly said, oh no. To myself, I do not drink alone. I drink with the fellows. I sing those Irish songs. You wonder why I sing Irish songs and I'm Scotsman? Doesn't matter. It's, you know, weird. I sing those Irish songs and I do this and I do that. We sing German songs. We sing anything as long as you get a drink. I I don't drink alone. Thank God it's not me. I got to tell you something. I was grounded when I went after that New York exposure, brought back to Goose Bay, Labrador, asked that silly question. I was grounded for 3 months and I was told, quote, take care of yourself. Now I must say here that all the military services now have programs, and we all know about that. They did not have them then. But I will say quickly that had they had them, this is my second language, by the way, so if I do a little... if they did have those programs, I would not have gone, unless I was forced to. So I'm not trying to say that had you offered this program to me, I'd be sober and now a colonel. Thank God I'm not. The point is this, that in those 3 months that I supposed to, quote, take care of myself in Goose Bay, Labrador, off flying status, not feeling good about myself, heard about Alcoholics Anonymous, but it was some kind of subculture. It certainly wasn't me. It was men I'd read somewhere. I think I read in Scotland one time as a kid about these men who met in some old church hall, and it was very dramatic, and I had this feeling everything was dreary, and they probably ran around with torn t-shirts with chili stains on them and a pack of cards in their back pocket. And I must say, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in New York City, that I fitted that description than anyone else in the room, by the way. But you know, this is what I thought it was. So in those 3 months, I took care of myself. I believe now as I'm speaking, there may have been AA on the Canadian side. I discovered that there was a Canadian side to that base. And we would go over there and drunk and get into fights with the Canadians. I'm a Scotsman with a Scottish accent. I'm in the American Air Force. The Canadians are confused. Who the hell is he? And I have a top secret clearance. I heard we had a spy here today. I won't tell you those things. I have these top secret clearances, and these Canadians are staring at me drunk with a Scottish accent. So you know there was confusion going on. But I do believe that there was AA on the Canadian side, but it doesn't matter. In the 3 months I should have taken care of myself, I retreated into my room. I listened to Winston Churchill records of talking about the glory days of the RAF. You know, never in a field of human conflict have so many owed so much to so few. And I would cry, and I would play this record over and over, and he'd talk about Britain and what we did, and I'd say, yeah, I got to get the hell out of here, and all this stuff. And I discovered the pill world, and I'll take about 2 minutes because I think it is important. This is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I got to tell you, I also ate my drinks as well as drink my drinks. I discovered through a flight surgeon who I met, with an Irish-American fellow, but Irish-American, and I was had an affinity with those type. And I said, Doc, I can't sleep. He says, hey, Scotty, this is 1962. We got a pill for everything. He gave me sleeping pills. I believe we now call them Quaaludes. Doesn't matter. One makes you sleep. Four makes you intoxicated if you fight sleep. And I discovered that quickly. And then when I couldn't get up in the morning, I said, Doc, those things work, but I can't get up in the mornings. Hey, Scotty, 1962, pill for everything. Gave me a jar of what he called jelly beans, Smith, Klein and French, 15 milligram dextroamphetamine sulfate with sodium amytal, wonderful pills, no more hangovers. I feel wonderful. I take those. If I had one in me tonight, I could look up and see that your air conditioning vents are dirty and they need dusting. And I want to get a ladder out and clean them right now. And I want to break the rules and smoke not only one cigarette, but four. I'll put them right across here. I would hope that telephone would ring behind me, and I'd like to argue with my girl out there. You see, that lady out there. All at once, that's what speed did for me. So in those 3 months that I should have been taking care of myself, I was killing myself. Put back on flying status after 3 months. No lecture, no discussion, no sensitivity training, no counseling. Get on, back on duty. We're flying old C-54s. C-130s were just coming in. A mission up to Thule, Greenland. A pilot had gone down and we had to find him. Couldn't find him because it was dangerous to look and stuff for weather reasons. We're put down. I went to my room because by this time I carried a bottle. You know, we're flying that heavy equipment and I carried a bottle. Not to drink it, you understand. But when you were off duty and you weren't going to fly for 12 hours, it was good to have a wee nip, you know what I mean, see? And so I just cracked that bottle. I cracked that bottle, the weather cleared and we were scrambled. And I went down to the flight control under the influence of alcohol. And you don't do that in the United States Air Force. And you don't do it in the Royal Air Force. You might do it in the Iranian Air Force. Ireland, they don't drink, right? You might do it in my beloved Irish Air Force, but you do not do it in this big outfit. Why? And you shouldn't. And so what happened was I was grounded, and it was the end of my career. I was court-martialed for that thing. I was let out at McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey. I was given whatever the percentage was, the cents in those days, 12 cents a mile, 14 cents, I don't know. And I was sent into New York City from McGuire Air Base out there in New Jersey, and I landed in New York City and self-pity. In fact, the only genuine emotion which stayed with me constantly was poor little old me. What has happened? I'm getting back to Scotland. These people out here are nuts. They don't understand me. Boy, do you understand me. I got two brothers drinking over there in Scotland now, and they don't understand me, and I don't understand them. I identify with my friend Walter more than I do with my brothers. And why shouldn't I? You know, this is a disease that has said it's equal opportunity, and it's equal opportunity to recovery too. You know, it's here for us. Anyway, I'm in New York City. I'm in a hotel room, it's the only thing I know what to do. Get in there and think it over. You know how alkies can spend about 3 weeks in a hotel room thinking things over? I look around the city and people are wearing suits, so I buy a suit. They're carrying briefcases, so I buy a briefcase. An attaché case, I believe you call them, and in that attaché case is an old a discharge which is honourable but not very nice, some old British pounds, an old pair of sneakers and some old diving equipment probably, and I'm walking up and down Park and Lexington and Madison wondering what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. In the hotel room I also have another disease. It's called black cord fever. It's called telephonitis, as a matter of fact. Telephonitis, you know, like black cord, it ages me, doesn't it? It makes me sound older than 42, because all telephones were black then. And I loved the telephone. I loved the telephone about 2:30 in the morning, when the rest of the world was asleep, and you have 45 milligrams of Dexamel in you, and the cigarettes taste good, and the whiskey tastes good, and you know you can solve the world's problems. And so on that telephone, I even called 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. And I got through, not to him, but I got through to someone. And within a few minutes, there was a knock on the door of that Warwick Hotel. And very guys in crew cuts and very paramilitary looking asked who I was. And they let me go. I was just a simple old drunk. I was going to tell them what I knew about what we were doing to Dr. Castro, what we were going to do in a few months' time. And you all know what we did. Nothing. Anyway, that's the disease. In there, drunk. Think about it. I'll do this. I've been told that someone had met me when I was in training and said, Scotty, if you ever get out of the military, come on down to Florida. We have work we could do together. And that was the ace up my sleeve. But I had this other disease called telephonitis. You see, on the phone. I would call up people in San Francisco. I'd call people in Britain. Made the cheapest call across the river to Brooklyn to my aunt, my mother's sister, my surrogate mother, and I said to her, hi Aunt Frances, how are you? She says, oh John, you're calling again. I says, what do you mean again? She says, you called today, what's wrong? I says, nothing's wrong. She says, are you on leave? I says, no, I got out of the military, I have some special duties I have to do, and it's better if I do them in a civilian status. Oh, rubbish, you see. And she said, you know, you sound drunk. I says, well, I'm drinking a little bit. Most people who get out of the military stay drunk for 30 days. Isn't that true? When you get out of the military, you're supposed to, it's an order, you're supposed to stay drunk for 30 days. Only alcoholics think that. Civilians don't. They get out of the military, 2 days later they go to their old job and they go back to work. Guys like me sit around for a month and think things over. She said to me in that call, the cheapest call, she said in no uncertain terms, you're drunk or you're an alcoholic. And I was insulted, and I thought, why did I make this call? And then she said the shocker. She said, your cousin Charlie, her son, is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And into my mind's eye came Charlie. You know, little Charlie, whom I did not like. He was, at that time, I was 28 years old, and he was probably 32. And that was kind of young, because, you know, alcoholics had to be as old as Walter. And she says, he's a member of AA, and if you wish to talk to him, he'll come over and see, where are you? And I, of course, I'm in the bed. You know, I'm in that way where you're on the edge of the bed, and one sock is on and one sock is off, and you're not sure if you're getting up or going back to bed. And the ice bucket is melted, and the cigarette ends are butts in that ice bucket, and your head hurts. And I felt like saying, sure, send them over, have them bring a carton of cigarettes and a bottle of whiskey. But out of great respect, I said, well, I'll see him. I did not like Charlie. And I'll tell you why I did not like Charlie. Charlie looked as if he was onto something. When I would go up to New York on leave, at weddings or whatever, visit family up there, they had sponsored me to the United States. Charlie always sat with the ladies and they giggled and he drank what I suspect was a soft drink. And I mixed with the Sullivans and the Murphys, and we drank and rolled on the floor. We were real men. And he sat there, and he looked calm. He had ease. And now I know why. And I said, oh God, all right, send them in. And the next day, my hotel room got a knock, and into my room walked Charlie. And I got to tell you something, folks. This is a fellowship. It's a program of attraction and not promotion. But never underestimate window dressing. Never underestimate it. It behooves me to act and look as well as I can, because Charlie looked so good and I felt so bad. And that's very important. My brain didn't say, oh, he's a member of AA, and you know, I know nothing about it. All I saw was ease. All I saw was wholesomeness, and I had become unwholesome. I was sick. And he said to me, not what his mother had said, like, you're a drunk. He smiled, because he was a member of AA, sober 3 or 4 years. And he said to me, John, I can't tell you you're an alcoholic. He said later, when we were both friends and sober, he says, but I felt like saying, you'll do until one comes along. We used to see up in New York, if you look like a duck and you walk like a duck and you quack like a duck and you smell like a duck, you're a duck. But he just said to me, I can't tell you, but here's the number of the intergroup office. I've got to go to business now. He had the briefcase. He had the crew cut. They all wore suits in those days. I'm wearing one tonight. And he left, and I, with the help of a taxi driver and some whiskey, I showed up at the intergroup office. And if some of you don't know New York, but it's down there. It was down there in the 30s between Lex and 3rd. And I walk in full of self-importance, and there's 7 million people up there, as you know. And I walk in, and little Doris Huger is behind the counter, running like a... She ran that shop like a general. She ran it toughly, and says, yes, 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 what do you want? I said, well, I'm here because my cousin thinks I might have a problem, you understand? And, you know, you probably know my cousin. She says, no, I don't. What is your name? She, and you know, quite firm. And I said, well, da-da-da-da-da. And she says, do you have any money? I says, yeah. She says, I think you should be detoxified, because you knew I was on these pills and on this booze. And I says, what does that mean? She says, well, you should go to a hospital. 1963, this was not a respectable disease. In the city of New York, no hospital would take you with a diagnosis of alcoholism. And I'm sure down in Georgia, they did not either. You could go in with anxiety reaction, or your mother didn't like you in 1946, or whatever these things were, or you didn't have a rubber duck in your bathtub, or whatever, you could go in there, but you could not, you know, or maybe today, inner child, you know, like my good friend, you know, was it Jack, where they said inner child, you know, that wonderful language, inner child, where the hell did that come from? Where is this coming from? I never heard Bill Wilson talk about inner child. I never heard Bill talk about a dysfunctional family, and he did have one. I never heard Bill talk about poor father image, and I hear Bill a lot. She said to me, you need detoxification. Where do I go? Charles B. Towns Hospital, Central Park West. Okay, born in 34, now it's 63, waiting for me. I go up there. I'm not impressed with the place. It's a little brownstone. $125, 5 days detoxification in the AA floor. I hear rumors, and it proves to be true, that up in the other floors they have all those movie stars and those television stars, and they dry out by getting a drink every hour. We don't get that done on the AA floor. And all I remember in there was being given, they were off paraldehyde then, they were given chlorohydrate, which calmed you down. In case you had a convulsion, with a lot of convulsions back then. You don't see a lot of stuff. You used to see a lot of guys with wine sores now. Only Walter has them. But you do not see that now. You know, I mean, guys 12 years sober still have wine sores. People were convulsing at meetings, hitting the deck. Bang! Well, listen, a convulsion at an AA meeting is worth 100 meetings to a newcomer. Believe me. In fact, we should do that. I've just had a brainwave. We ought to bring someone in and throw a convulsion. If someone wonders what kind of disease this is, you see a convulsion, a pretty lady wetting herself because she's incontinent. That'll get your attention. But they would give you chlorohydrate because it's calmed you down. So I'm in there and I don't know where to shower, and people came up to visit me, and I'm almost embarrassed to say this, because in my cynicism I thought, as they visited me, they will charge a consultation fee downstairs. And I said, I don't want to talk to you people. And I had these impersonal cab drivers come in. And you know what the AA language is like when you don't want to be in AA. It's all repetitious. They would say these silly things like, I drank like you did, kid. Because I was kid then. 28, 63, very few 28-year-olds. You had to be at least as old as you-know-who. And as ugly. And I said, get away, I don't want to hear about it. And I turned my back to the wall. Big Irish nurse came in, she had a shine on me, I think because she was from the other side too. I mean, she was a mother image, frankly. Whoa. And she said, how are you, dear boy? You should be ashamed of yourself. She was not in the program, she was just a nurse. And she gave me lectures on what I was doing and all that. And I said, oh, well, leave me alone. I said, where do you get a shower? She says, tomorrow morning we'll take you up to the fifth floor where all the people go in to the shower. Charles B. Towns Hospital did not have showers. They had what they called hydrotherapy on the top floor. I call it sadism. They had a room about half the size of this and all tiles. And what they did was, you went in there and they turned the hoses on you and you skidded all over the floor. And they would bring the other people in from the top floor, and names I ought not to mention and will not mention. Many of them are dead, but you would know who they were. And they would come in, and not in all their glory with TV makeup on, they would come in with those. They used to give you pajamas that had no cord on it, so you had to hold them up like this, and paper slippers that you had to shuffle. Now, today you would never do that. You think of the psychological damage. You're feeling like hell. You're holding on like Jimmy Cagney, like this. And you got paper slippers where you can't lift your feet. And you shuffle. You're 28 years old and you're shuffling. We have come a long way. Although people still get drunk, but we've come a long way. Anyway, you go up there to that fifth floor, and out come the swells and the swanks, and they look the same as you when they take their clothes off. And when that hose goes in, they squeal like crazy. And I skidded around that floor, and the cold water, and they would hit sensitive parts. I don't know if that was part of their training, but they seemed to get a thrill out of And I came off that floor, down in the creaky elevator. That big Irish nurse said to me, oh dear boy, you look terrible. I says, nurse, I threw up with that cold water. I called her sister, because we call nurses sister in Britain. And she says, oh dear boy, she says, come with me into the nurse's station. And she brings out that big dark bottle, that dark green or brown bottle with chlorohydrate. And she gives me a shot. There you go, dear boy. Well, you know the rest of my 5 day stay that I was sick at least three times a day. And so I really stayed quite drunk in there. Okay, that was my experience with Charles B. Tyler. Co-founder has a spiritual experience there. It doesn't mean a thing. sobriety in this part of Georgia is just as good if you've never been in towns, if you've never seen Bill Wilson, if you've never been near those places, if you believe in the principles and techniques of Alcoholics Anonymous, it works just fine. I'm in there, people, one guy came to see me, he was about maybe 2 years old, and at least I could identify. Well, I only identify people who had crew cuts, who had been court-martialed, and who'd been in the military. And so, you know, and he was a lot of old World War II vets would come in, but this guy came in and he said he was quite bright looking and he said he'd been sober 2 years. And where are you going, Scotty, when you leave here? And I had some funds left, not much. And I said, well, I don't know, I think I'll go back to Scotland, or, you know, I'll go to Florida, I got some underwater work I have to do, and so on. And he said, Scotty, there's a little farm up in Kent, Connecticut called High Watch Farm. High Watch Farm is the mother of all treatment centers. It was the first one that was given to Alcoholics Anonymous, who would not accept it because you couldn't. So it's called the Ministry of the High Watch. I'll be up there next Sunday, God willing, when they're having their annual picnic. And I went up to High Watch Farm because they were going to drive me up there, and it was $65 a week, $1963, that you had to stay for 2 weeks. I went up, get out with the briefcase. Now I'm 5 days, so briefcase, marching down. You know, Mister, who's that important guy? I think he's a Canadian flyer, you know. Oh, okay. You know, all the rumors in those drunk farms, you know. And my eye is educated. I'm looking around me and I spot one gal who's under 35. And she's got a black eye and her hair is up. And I said, maybe I will stay. See, the motivations were not there. The motivation was wrong. The attitude was wrong. I discovered her name, and she's a wonderful AA member today. I married her. But she's a wonderful AA member today called Glendora, the glorious Glendora. I think Perry Como wrote a song one time, "Oh Glendora, I want to see more of you." I think it might have been for her. I used to go and eat in Mama Leone's there on 3rd Avenue. But Glendora was now out of the modeling business. Glendora was puffed up. Glendora had a black eye. But at least she could walk. We had some damaged people up there. And when they put me into a little room, there was one old boy in there, and God love him, he kept me awake. And you know that you don't pay $65 up there and be kept awake by this old man. And he would get up in the middle of the night, and I'd hear, and now I know it's emphysema. A lot of us know about that today. And it was Abby Thatcher. And you know who Abby is. You AA historians know who Abby is. And Abby brought the message to Bill at Clinton Street in 1934. You know, it took him to Towns Hospital, as a matter of fact. Abby is the one who said to Bill, "Bill, you've got to give back. You've got to clean house. You cannot do this alone." Abby's drunk in 63. God love him. He's one of my roommates. We stayed in a chicken coop with five or six other people. They're all older than I am, and you know what they do. Walter does it today. All those old men, they fart and they cough, and you know, and I did not do that. I was young and I was 5 days sober, and I complained. And I said, I've got to get out of here. Went to see the manager, you know, quite arrogant, quite cocky. And he says, yeah. And he sent me to another room with guys who were better detoxified. Because guys were throwing fits up there in those days. Bang, bang, bang. A few days later, there's a big hug. I meet Glendora, of course, and I charm her because I'm no longer shy. I no longer have pimples. I have collected a little bit of savoir faire along the way, you know, which we call bullshit, I think. And it's a blind leading the blind. She's just gone through a divorce, and she's, oh, the Canadian flyer and the New York model, you know. And we are just walking through the farm, and I would keep the big book under my arm and walk past the manager's office twice a day to let him see I'm studying. A few days later, a big hush. Bill Wilson is up here. Oh, who the hell is Bill Wilson? He's up to see Abby, you see. He's up to see, and out the car comes this guy. Blue suit, blue shoes, blue tie, blue shirt. Blue eyes, pale. I thought he was a guest. I thought he was a patient coming in as our co-founder. I don't care. I say to Glendora, who is Bill Wilson? And being a very bright lady, being in that modeling field and being sophisticated in Manhattan, she says, Bill Wilson, if it wasn't for him, we could be having a cool one today. And that sounded good. That was the attitude about... Before I forget, it is nice to hear laughter, and that's great, but I'm not a professional or an entertainer, and it's nice to hear laughter. I'm all for it. Let me understand that I don't take myself too seriously, but this disease of alcoholism I do take seriously. But let's laugh if we may. We know how to cry, right? You know, and we've done it. And I didn't care. And Bill shook hands and all that. Now, I was privileged later because of my time in the fellowship and because where I stayed and because of the generation thing, that to get to know Bill obviously quite well because we lived there. Bill worked every Tuesday at the General Service Office and you didn't see him. But anyway, 2 weeks up there, I get well physically, right? Threefold disease, 28 years old, couple of days in the sun, running around, impressing Glendora, falling in love. They should sell that stuff, that feeling of, oh, you can't wait to see her again, and you're looking at your hair, and you're combing your eyebrow, you know all that goes on. It's like nuts. It's an unnatural situation. But it brings us together, doesn't it? And she said to me, when we get down to New York, we'll keep each other sober. What an original line, right? I think it's called the blind leading the blind. And so her mother picks her up and gives me the hairy eyeball because her mother spots what's going on and I'm trying to be charming. And I meet her in Manhattan and I got to tell you something. I learned nothing up there. I heard those dreary old people up there talking about, hey kid, you can't drink again. If you ever pick up a drink, and I'm sober 12 years now. Oh God, the dreary old men. You know, I'll get off my back. I'm never going to do that. And Glendora and I play footsie under the table. When I get down to Manhattan, I've never really been, as a military man, I've never really had a lot of relationships, as they say, and I didn't know how to handle the situation unless I had a drink. And that didn't change. And when she was in her bathroom doing her makeup, because we were going to go out when I got into town, she told me she had booze in the house. Now, we've been told up there that you don't keep booze in the house, but, you know, we're different, you know that. I don't know if some of you feel like that today. You're not supposed to keep booze in the house if you're nearly sober, but some of you say, it's okay, I won't drink it anyway. Hey, I got to tell you something. She went to the bathroom, and I'd never been in her apartment, but I'd had a mental plan of her apartment, and she told me where she kept it. She's in there singing and happy, and I'm up on top of the couch, and into a cupboard, and I got this two bottles, one is gin and one is whiskey, and I'm hoping it's whiskey and it's a damn gin bottle, but I've no time, and it's one of those Gordon's gins with that little, I don't know if they still have it, a little key, a little metal thing that you clip up, and I broke a nail on the damn thing, and I threw it in again, and I grabbed my 24-hour book, you know that little black book? It's torn today, but I still use it. And I look at it upside down as she comes out, you know. And she comes, what are you doing? I said, well, she says, I smell alcohol. And I give her that silly grin. And she says, you're drinking. I said, I said, well, if you're going to drink, I'm going to drink. But we'll do it different this time. We'll do it properly. So she got egg whites and she squished it up. Because we had heard at the farm that you will never drink socially again. And they were wrong. We did drink socially. For about 2.5 hours we drank socially. And then it was a policeman, it was her mother, it was her father, it was the cops. New York cops have seen everything. They didn't arrest me. They said, lady, do you want to charge him? She's crying. No, I don't want to charge him. I'm falling over the banister. I'm singing Scottish songs to her father, whose name is Donaldson. He's angry, but he likes the songs. The whole damn thing is crazy. They whip her back to the farm, the High Watch farm, and I wander the streets. And what happens in those next 6 weeks brings me in here to September the 29th of 63. Because in those 6 weeks, everything that had not happened, happened. The yets happened. And I think it's because I was no longer innocent. I think up now, when I mean innocent, I don't mean baby like innocence. I mean, I was naive deliberately and innocent deliberately about the disease of alcoholism. Because what happened was that I knew now that when I picked up a drink, what was going to happen, and it did. And I couldn't wait to have it all over. And I went right down the tubes. The money was gone. I slept in Grand Central Station. The briefcase was still with me with nothing in it. And I walked up and down. Those cops said, let me see your ticket, kid. And I had no ticket. Get out of the station. And at the end of 6 weeks, I come back into this fellowship. Got an unemployment claim because I was an honorably discharged veteran. And started this magnificent journey. My motivation was not pure. And in that 6 weeks, by the way, I had gone up to visit a sister in Connecticut. I often say this, I woke up in a place, did not, blackouts were part of this, woke up in a, did not know where it was. Someone had said they thought they were in a club, but it was somewhere else. They were in a mental hospital. I think it was Roy at dinner. I woke up in this place and I thought, what is going on in here? My friend Ray says it had architectural deficiencies. I say that the room I was in had building code violations. There was no doorknobs in my side of the door. I couldn't get out. I was in the Fairfield Hill State Hospital. This was a journey now. I was into pawn shops. They get money. 20 days in jail in Bridgeport or get out of town. I have no $20. I have an Omega Seamaster watch. Get $60. Pay the $20. Get the hell out. Okay, thank God for progression, as long as I have what I have today. Thank God there was no one to help me. I really mean that, except you people were always willing to help me. But thank God there was no enablers to help me. So I come through these doors on that date in September in a position that our co-founder calls sweetly reasonable, as only the dying can be. I was hurting. I didn't want to die. I didn't want to die yet. And what happened was this journey that all of us can do today, whether you're one day sober or 1 month sober. I think someone said today, and I respectfully love him and disagreeably agree with him, that don't drink and go to meetings means more than don't drink and go to meetings. It means that if I use that phrase to newcomers today, it means that in this room, those are the two things I do that I won't get drunk, but in this room, hopefully, things will happen. But it has to start with don't drink and come to this meaningful communication. And that's what I did. My motives were not pure. I postponed disbelief. I did what you were doing. I think in normal life that I think before I act. I think I will have this cup and have a drink of it. And I do it. I reverse that process in Alcoholics Anonymous. Instead of thinking my way into right acting, I act my way into right thinking. I do what you are doing, and lo and behold, it catches up with me, and I figured I've thought this all out by myself. You know, the ego. The ego. I did this all by myself. But I did those things. I imitated you. I imitated the people who were staying sober, and lo and behold, I get sober. And sure, moments come in. When I was in these rooms in the beginning, behind us, we'd have those 12 and 12. I remember looking at them. And in those days, I thought they were yellow. I thought it was only years later I discovered they were given out by General Service, and they were white. But in all rooms in New York City, they were yellow. Because you know why? 300 in a room, and 400 of the 300 smoked. And they were yellow, and you would see, you couldn't see the first step or the 12th step because they were rolled up, and when they dropped them, you see 2 to 11. But that was enough for me. I looked at those steps and I thought, oh my God, one of those looked like a mixture of the Ten Commandments and a major portion of the British Penal Code. And they do not apply to me. Those are not for me. I don't need those things. I drink a little too much, now things will be all right. Well, you know what happened. You know what happened. Don't drink and go to meetings means that I become seduced. I discovered the importance, and I pass this on to anyone because I do not see it too much anymore, is the strength and the structure of belonging to a group. When I come into this fellowship, I have isolated myself. Alcoholism is an isolator for this alcoholic. I thought it was attractive. When I was a child, even a child before alcohol, I would see Robert Mitchum or whoever it was before him. Into the sunset, and me in the big city of Glasgow had never seen the Wild West, and that to me looked very attractive. And I thought, when I grow up, I'm going to go out there and ride that horse and go over that sunset. That is not good thinking. I do not enjoy good mental health when I think like that. You know, I do not enjoy good mental health when I pick up a substance that gets me in trouble time after time with the naive idea that this time it will be different. I have a dog at home, you know, and if I gave that dog some whiskey because she was thirsty and she licked it and she danced around and chased her tail and threw up and hid under the house, the next morning when I poured some more whiskey and said, come on, Heather, come on, she would sniff it and take off. You know what I would do? I would kneel down and wait. Please pour me some more. I do not enjoy good mental health. And I have to remember that when I come in here. So, you know, if I'm left to my own devices, I would get drunk. I went against my instincts. I joined a group. It was forced up there. A couple of things I did up there was they said, join a group and get a sponsor. You don't have to join this group, Scotty. And I used the, what I thought was an original phrase. I thought, join a group means there's 900 up there, so I'm looking around. I'm looking around. I'm not looking around. I'm postponing. I'm not putting an anchor down. I'm not allowing you to get to know me. I want to be a drifter. I want to be a floater. Come in a couple of minutes late and get the hell out. Not because I'm devious, but because I'm ill at ease. I have no ease. I have a disease. I am without ease. And you can give me ease, and I'm rejecting it. Please, if you're new or not so new, the magic in this fellowship, I think, is in belonging. And you're looking at a cynical guy who was so cynical that he didn't want to belong to anything. I'd been in the military, and you know you never volunteer for anything. And I got in here feet first. Because this to me is a participation thing. It is not an observing thing. I do not go well intellectually. I do not go well by listening to you and saying, oh, that's what it means. I think I'll look that up in my bedroom tonight in the big book. I get well in the belly. I get well in the gut. And it moves up to the heart. And then the head, maybe. And the head's the last, frankly. So it behooves me to, you know, to act my way into right thinking. I joined the group. I belonged. I've had a tough time. I've had troubles in sobriety. Time has passed for me. I married that lady, Glendora. We were married for 17 years. We were divorced for reasons other than alcoholism. She's a good friend. I will see her next week. I was remarried a few years later. I've been divorced a second time. That current ex-wife prefers to be single, and I do not wish to discuss it here. It's caused me great pain. It's confusing, those small children with that. I'm in, and I see this with amusement, in that pink t-shirt syndrome. Do you know what the pink t-shirt syndrome is? It means that men who have been used to women washing their clothes, and suddenly they are on their own, and they look at those strange, even me who knows all about airplanes, looks at a washing machine and doesn't follow directions, even though you're sober a few 24 hours. So you throw everything in the washing machine. She didn't know any better. Geraldine did the washing at the old house. But you throw all your stuff in, and that pair of red socks that you're fond of, that goes in with it, and everything comes out pink. So if you ever see a guy with pink handkerchiefs and pink t-shirts, he's either separated or he's just been divorced. You don't have to be a detective. I say that with laughter. I've had troubles, but I've got to tell you something. When I was drinking, I was always in trouble. Now I have them. Now I have the philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a sponsor. I belong to a group. I brought the steps. Jack very eloquently described the steps this afternoon. I brought the steps into my life. And those things like looked like that hindrance to my happiness became stepping stones to freedom. Alcoholics Anonymous works so well. They say that AA does not promise to open the gates of heaven and let you in, but it does promise to open the gates of hell and let you out. And I think that's very true. People say to me today, you know, Scotty, has AA changed? Has this happened? And I say, and I forget that maybe time has passed for me, because I am only 42 and I've only, you know. And I say, well, I don't know. I went over to Scotland in 84 till 90 and of course was involved in AA over there. And when I come back, the language had changed. I think when you're living here, it comes in an insidious fashion and you don't notice it. But I noticed it being away 6 years. I hear little things in AA today that I never heard before. I don't know if it's right or wrong. You know, I hear, works if you work it. I never heard that in a meeting before. I know our friends in the treatment facilities probably spread that language. I hear a lot of chanting, a lot of cheerleading, like, you know, who keeps you sober? Our Father who art. We used to just say the Our Father. Because even though I believe in a higher power, it is a very personal thing. And I'm always sensitive to someone who's entitled to be in this room who may not believe they get sober with God. So when someone says, who's Father, let me be mindful that he's entitled to her or she's entitled to her opinion. So I hear those changes. I don't know if that's sinister or not. I'm going to stay sober. I'm going to keep coming to meetings. I suspect it has come from treatment centres, but our good friends over there have helped many people, so I have no strong opinion on that. But I do think maybe some of us, maybe diplomatically, ought to go into those places and say, keep it there. I do a beginners meeting up in Columbia, South Carolina, and after the surrender, they yell, just for today. And I say, what is that all about, you know? So I don't know if that's important or not. Maybe things should change. But I know that this fellowship is infallible, and it really doesn't need much changing. It works very well. I don't work that well. I really don't work that well. Someone says, you still go to meetings, Scotty? I says, yeah, I still shave. I still groom myself. I still eat with my good friend Walter, who drove me here, that wonderful friend I have, who's a delightful guy. Yes, I do all those things. And I really think this, and I say this with tongue in cheek, and there's no comparison, believe me, but I would say this, that Alcoholics Anonymous is like the mafia. You leave, you die. Okay? And so please, and I don't want to die, I want to live. This has given me life. Okay? Now I've got to close because I'm looking at this watch. And I don't know what I've said. I think if I could say one thing, if you're new, if you're wavering, if you're not sure, come back. There's someone else here whom you'll identify with. I identified when I was sober 3 or 4 years. I only used to identify with people, like, as I told you, and they were all World War II vets who had crew cuts, who drank torpedo juice, which I never did, but they were crew cuts and they were court-martialed, and they're all dead now, God love them, you know, all ex-New York cops, you know, beery faces and names like Sullivan, they're gone, but sober, tough. And I never identified with you ladies. About 4 years sober, a lady from Greenwich, Connecticut, who was hospitality chairman at that group, and who brought her butler when she was hospitality chairman. She thought that the butler would put out the cookies and the coffee. I said, no, you don't do that, darling. You do not do that. That's for you. You do it. Send them home. And when she told her story, she said her children came home from school one day, and they said, Mummy, she says, where is your pals? She says, Mummy, we don't want to bring our pals into this house anymore because we're embarrassed for you. I felt her pain. I'd never have kids say that to me. My children have seen me sober, but I felt her pain. That's identifying. Before I was comparing. I had a marvelous experience now. I got off a couple of weeks ago, it was June. I'm back over a couple of weeks. Went to the 50th British Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous in Blackpool, which is on the East Coast. 10,000 people there on a Sunday, all singing one day at a time. This fellowship works. This is a miracle factory. It behooves me to be part of that miracle. It really does. So I want to thank you. You know, Dr. Bob is gone. Of course, I never knew Dr. Bob. Abby's gone. I knew Abby. He died up in McPike's Farm in Ballston Spa in New York. Let me tell you one thing. When Bill came up to visit Abby that day, Abby took Bill up to the corner up by the leper colony in High Watch. And Abby did the talking. And Bill listened. And I don't care what they write in the big book, Abby was Bill's sponsor. Not Dr. Bob. Abby was Bill's sponsor. And Bill would have said that. They used to say to Bill, Abby is bad-mouthing you all over. You know, he's drunk. And Bill said a wonderful phrase. He said, you know, he said, I don't care. He said, Abby came into my life at the right time in the right place. At Clinton Street, when he told me about the Oxford movement, when he told me I can't do it alone, he said, he came in. He said, so the message is more important than the messenger. And that was a wonderful line, you know what I mean? So, you know, let us pass on this message. Abby's gone, Bill is gone, but Alcoholics Anonymous is working just fine in Cartersville, Georgia. And we've come a long way from Akron, Ohio. Thank you very much.